Hi, I'm Michael Silverblatt. Thanks for tuning in to Bookworm. Some of our most exciting storytellers share their work orally, and that's the kind of work you can hear on KCRW's Unfictional. Intimate stories, cleverly made documentaries, produced all around the world by some of the most talented radio producers we have. Check out Unfictional. You can find it on KCRW's iTunes page.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gunnar Zindberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, it's my honor, my pleasure, my excitement, my delight to have the estimable and inimitable Kazuo Ishiguro with me. His new book is The Buried Giant. It's published by Knopf. I want to say out front, I can't think of a way to talk about this book without involving so-called spoilers. So, if you're planning to read the book and are afraid of such things, wait until after you've read the book to listen to the show. I would say to you that this is a book that's rich and strange, and you don't have to worry about spoilers. There'll be enough in the book to fascinate you, even if you know certain things. Now, Kazuo, what was the inception of The Buried Giant?
Well, this might seem rather strange, but it wasn't Arthurian legends. You know, it wasn't kind of anything to do with that kind of stuff. It was probably the disintegration of Yugoslavia on the doorstep of where I live in Europe, and shortly afterwards the Rwandan genocide. Both of those events got me thinking about the role of societal memory in conflict situations. In Bosnia, what seemed to have happened was that these people had been living in, maybe uneasy peace, but these two, at least two or three ethnic groups had been living, coexisting pretty peacefully for at least a generation. They were using each other as babysitters, living in the same villages. And then somehow, very suddenly, perhaps as a result of cynical manipulation by people in power, one group remembered, in quotes, terrible things that the other group had done to them a generation back during the Second World War and beyond, further back, and turned with almost unbelievable viciousness. So I think it was around then I started to think a lot about wanting to write a novel about how communities or nations remembered and forgot, how sometimes they managed to bury certain kinds of dark memories, how sometimes those dark memories came back to life, sometimes deliberately, brought back to life. But that question, when is it better to remember, when is it better to forget, was one of the questions that I became very interested in. It's a question I've always been interested in, at the individual level. I wanted to ask it at the level of a society.
As I read The Buried Giant, I thought, when did it become okay to kill women and children? When did we forget that we had once made an agreement about this, that there would be a law of innocence and that the elderly, women and children, were not to be slain, non-participants? And then, gradually, in The Buried Giant, I understood that such a concept, at least in this book, goes back to King Arthur.
There is some evidence to suggest that there was such a law, an agreement to leave the non-combatants out of it. And this is an urge that comes back over and over again in history. The kind of idealistic belief that wars could be settled simply with the soldiers meeting in a special kind of field, like it's a football match or something, and you leave the innocents out. But sooner or later, that breaks down because people realize that you know, the children are that's the next generation of enemies.
First of all, what years in British history are we talking about approximately?
This is approximate, but we're talking about at 490 AD. The Romans leave Britain in 410. The people called the Anglo-Saxons, very loosely, the people settling, they're the immigrants coming over from the European mainland, are settling all over Britain and becoming ever more powerful and numerous. The indigenous people who are left behind after the Romans, people I call the Britons, some people call them the Celts or the Romano-Celts, for some time fought a kind of rearguard action against the people who are settling. But there does seem to be in a period of uneasy coexistence. And I'm positing that perhaps this period of uneasy coexistence that went on for perhaps a generation or so was created by force. And I guess in this story, yes, I mean, I have created a slightly kind of fantasy version of that time.
Yes, and what happens, it seems to me, is that we're given constantly a choice between bad choices. Our characters, three of them, are escaping from a monastery which they don't realize is in fact being taken over by an enemy. As they move forward through an underground tunnel, the door behind them closes. But as they move forward, they realize there's a monster of sorts ahead of them. So the choice becomes, shall they lower this portcullis, this cage that will prevent the monster from reaching them? Which means in turn that they'll be enclosed on both sides now. The entrance blocked, progress forward blocked, because these bars are now preventing this mad dog monster from reaching them. And so they're trapped doubly. And this trapping keeps occurring throughout the book. But there's no moment at which there's a good choice. There's a good thing to do. The right thing is never in evidence, which I think is the book's idea of the condition of war.
Yeah, it's very interesting to think about that little moment. It probably is an emblem of the dilemmas, you know, that throughout the book. As you say, you know, these choices, the characters. I mean, let's just leave the war aspect to one side. I mean, if we just look at the love story in the book, it's a very similar kind of entrapment. I mean, they're caught between the choice of whether to remember the dark moments of their marriage or to just leave them forgotten.
Now, this too is brilliant. The characters are Axel and Beatrice. They don't understand. They want to visit their son, but they don't remember where he left for, when he left, what he looks like, why he left. They come to understand that there's a mist of some kind causing amnesia, forgetfulness. They don't understand why they seem to be outsiders in their own community, but they do decide to leave, to go to visit their son. They assume as they get closer to him, they'll know where he is. And that's when we start to encounter the special quality of this book, which is if they do remember, they'll remember what they did to chase their son away, and they may come to hate each other for what they've done. If they don't remember, they may never know where to wander to. They may never know if they've found their son or not. Any pretender might be their son. In fact, I would say that as we read the book, there are several possibilities of men they meet who might just be their son until we find out that the choice is beyond reclamation. Spoiler!
But it's not just that choice of whether they'll find their son or not. They fear if they can defeat this mist that's taking away their memories and get their precious memories back. Yes, there is this problem. The bad memories will come with the good ones. But on the other hand, they sense that their time together is not long now. They're elderly. They don't acknowledge it, but Beatrice is seriously ill, and they wonder that how long can you keep the dark memories buried in a marriage that's by and large a very successful one, and I suppose they also fear, since their time together perhaps is not long now, they fear that if they don't actually face the dark memories as well, their love is based on something completely phony. It's a false love. It's based on a false premise.
We're talking about The Buried Giant by my guest Kazuo Ishiguro. And what you can see is that the giant, whatever it may be, lies buried because memory is as viable as the loss of memory. That yes, there's a giant down there. Yes, it is buried. If it rises, so bad for us. If it stays down there, so bad for us. It seems to me to be a very, you'll pardon me, contemporary circumstance that whether we win or lose, we lose.
I don't know if my vision is quite so pessimistic as that. What you're really saying is that you're stuck between two bad choices. Well, sometimes I think there are positive outcomes. I think there are times when you can get that balance between remembering and forgetting right. And if we're talking at the societal level, I'll give the example in recent history. I'll give the example of South Africa coming out under apartheid. I think it's almost miraculous that that society didn't descend into mayhem and civil war when the apartheid era came to an end. Europe after the Second World War is another case, I would say. Many, many dark memories had to be buried, not only in the part of Germany, about Nazism, but all the countries in Europe that have been occupied and had collaborated to a large extent. But somehow I think Europe after the Second World War is a positive example of where if you compare Europe in the first half of the 20th century with the Europe in the second half of the 20th century, it is almost miraculous, the actual peace and coexistence that has been achieved. And I think, so I wouldn't always say that the choice between remembering what do you bury, when do you allow the giant to come back up again? I mean, sometimes you can say yes, let the buried giants rise a little bit, and we'll look at it. We can deal with it. And sometimes it's successful. It's not always between two disastrous choices.
You're quite right. Sometimes in the world, there are settlements that we can make that are very, very delicate and miraculous. But is there any instance where peace has come about because peace was wanted?
I think so. I think I wouldn't be too pessimistic about the ability to achieve peace with some depth. I would hope that the end of the long sectarian violence between Catholics and Protestants in Northern Ireland is a proper negotiated, hard-won peace. It's not a case that one side has just conquered the other side and enforced the peace and somehow controlled the means by which communities remember in order to maintain that peace, which is what's happened in my book.
I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from KCRW. I'm talking with Kazuo Ishiguro about his book, The Buried Giant. We'll continue after this short break.
Immerse yourself in Rhythm Planet, hosted by Tom Schnabel, the world music blog and podcast dedicated to history, storytelling, and, of course, the music. Check it out now at kcrw.com/rhythmplanet.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm, and I'm talking with Kazuo Ishiguro about his recent book, The Buried Giant, a novel that takes the reader along on a misty, sometimes dark, and dreamy journey. I fell in love with this book. It had to do first with the beauty of its cover, and at least the first edition has pages tipped in black ink so that you're entering something dark and mysterious enclosed within the bog. And I had such a good time just holding the book. And then, let's face it, who doesn't like King Arthur? And as I read the book, I found myself in a completely sensual world. The darkness made me quite frightened. Creatures coming at you from in front of you and behind you, and characters who seem, well, first, oh, here's our rescuer, a very famous knight left over from Arthur's day makes an appearance. But then he's not quite the rescuer we wanted. That ambivalence and the way the story keeps shifting. I mean, I think in this book, you're that rare thing, an arbiter of storytelling.
Well, that's very kind of flattering to hear. I guess I am trying to create, in any novel, I'm trying to create a kind of a self-contained world in which, you know, the reader can get lost. It would have to operate by its own slightly different rules, and it would have to have its own special atmospheres. One of the guiding principles I had when writing and creating this, the world of the buried giant, was that if the people of that time, the primitive people, pre-scientific people, could quite reasonably believe in certain kinds of supernatural forces. I mean, and why wouldn't they? They live in these kind of huddled little communities with miles and miles of untamed moorland in darkness, you know, between them and the next settlement. I mean, why wouldn't they believe in all kinds of forces? If, for instance, somebody dear to you gets ill, you know, you don't have science to explain it, and you want an explanation. So it seems to me perfectly reasonable
To travel to visit magicians.
Well, not only to do that, but to seek a kind of explanation along the lines of, yes, now I remember, maybe, you know, a couple of months back, I thought there was a pixie moving in the darkness of our room in the dead of night. And now that my beloved is ill, I'm sure that's when she got ill, that pixie brought some illness and gave it to her then. That's why she's in this condition.
It's very important, not just that the characters feel endangered. As a reader, I felt endangered too. There was a quality in this, I hope you like this, that made me say, oh, mommy, the pixies are angry and they're swarming. There's a swarm of pixies. They're like a cluster, a hive of insects that has been disturbed. And I felt quite primally frightened. You were restoring primal fear to my experience of reading. And so there's a certain level of fear and surprise that operates throughout the buried giant that's very exciting. In an adult, whatever you want to call it, an adult fantasy, an adult allegory, I don't know, in fact, what it is. What I like is not being quite certain.
Well, I'm kind of pleased about that, Phil, but we live in that kind of world in reality, don't we? I mean, we live in a world where there are lots of things that don't have explanations, where we are afraid. I mean, there are many kinds of illness that we fear. There are many dangers that we face as a society that we fear. Things are out of control. We don't have good explanations for it.
Well, also, an extraordinary question. The extraordinary unanswerable question. How much do you love me? Not just do you love me, but how much and will you always love me? Have you always loved me? Was there a time that we don't remember when we didn't love each other? Can we survive if that revelation is put forward to us that we once seriously didn't love one another? Can we survive the revelation? So in this novel, we may slip-slide from the questions of an old couple whose love for one another seems to be relatively pure, or at least it is now. We enter a kind of what might be political, what might be allegorical, a world in which many things are uncertain, and we return to the question of love. And by the end of the book, that question is still, despite the fact that these people have promised upon promise that they can forgive each other, that they will forgive each other should something awful happen, that they can count on each other's forgiveness. By the end of the book, that's still far from confidently ascertained. That love seems, by the end of the book, to be the unanswerable question.
They have a faith that, or a hope that, you know, their love is strong enough to defeat, perhaps not defeat death, but at least win a few concessions from death. And I think that I find that touching about people, you know, when they feel they have won love, and it's a very hard won love. Particularly, you know, love that has been fought for over years and decades. You know, so here we have a couple who are determined to keep that flame alive and to stand by each other, you know, right to the end. But as you say, that these questions come up in a big way.
Is there anything buried more deeply than love when it's problematic? And is there anything bigger? It's not an easy answer. You don't come away from the book saying the buried giant is love, but maybe the buried giant is the loss of love. And it seemed to me to be a book that was glorious because it was so sensible, careful, squint-eyed, wary, as it looked at what love can be and do. Everywhere I look, when they talk to you, you say, I started to write this book and then my wife told me it was not good. So I wrote it again and then my wife said maybe. It seemed to me to be a book born out of a partnership and a complete trust whether the creative aspects of that partnership would outlast this book, that somehow or other this book is about love or is born out of love or is refuted by love, whatever it is, it's an extraordinary thing to do.
I just happened to blurt this out once at a festival about 6 months ago, and then for some reason, you know, every interview I have done, the person just wants to hear about it again. I think my wife is getting a little bit tired of hearing. She thinks she's been cast as Lady Macbeth or something in this whole story. But it's quite interesting to know why people are so fascinated by this one casual anecdote I happened to come up with spontaneously. But it's
because
the one thing everybody wants to know about.
Because if there's anything that's been threatened in our time, we expect nations to be threatened. We expect borderlines to be threatened. We expect religious faith to be threatened. Love is the one thing we want to see left standing. It's sort of like if you're going to, if an author speaks about it directly, of course we're all going to jump down that rabbit hole. We want to hear about the safety and sanctity of love. Oh, tell us a story about love-ish. Tell us that this story outlasts the death of anything but love.
Well, that's good. The title of my last novel, Never Let Me Go, to some extent, it could be applied to this book as well. I mean, I think that phrase, Never Let Me Go, which isn't a phrase that I invented, it happens to be the title of a jazz standard, you know, but it always appealed to me and to some extent goes to the heart of the kind of books I've been writing recently, because that request, Never Let Me Go, is unreasonable. It's impossible. You can ask someone to keep hold of you for a long time, you know, that's okay. That's achievable. Once you say never let me go, you're asking for the impossible. You're saying at once, you know, I don't ever want to lose you. But you kind of acknowledge that it's impossible, because it can never be granted, that request, never let me go. Something is sooner or later going to come and separate you. And I think in that plea, there's an acknowledgement of the impossibility of the plea itself. And probably at the heart of The Buried Giant and the relationship between the couple, I mean, they too, you know, want to say never let me go, but they understand that that's actually an impossible request.
I've been talking with Kazuo Ishiguro, author of The Buried Giant, published by Knopf. Thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be here again.
It's great to see you, and it's great to read a book that stirred me up so much. You can comment on today's show or read an excerpt from The Buried Giant at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. My co-producer is Connie Alvarez. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to my assistant, David Sobel. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
Read this, read that, read this, bookworm. Read this, read that, read this. I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Thomas McGuane is our guest.
I am a bookworm. We are all bookworms.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Raptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.